Kia ora and welcome. I'm Boris Lamont and you are listening to the New Zealand Wine Podcast. Thanks for joining us. In this episode, we're speaking with Hazely McDonald from Te Pa Wine in Marlborough at the top of the South Island here in New Zealand. The McDonald family started making wine early 2000s on their family farm and have grown substantially into a few different brands now, exporting around the globe. So right now, let's go have a chat with Hazely. So hi, Hazely. How are you?
Yeah, very good, Boris.
Welcome to the New Zealand Wine Podcast, and thanks for taking the time to join us. We appreciate that. And understand are you at one of the wineries at the moment in the office, or?
I'm just tucked up in my office at the moment and blending here, so nice day, and thanks for reaching out, and happy to join you today.
Yeah, no, it's great. So, yeah, maybe we'll just wind back and tell us how your journey started with, where it's got to now with Te Pa Wines, and how that all came about for you, and you know, understand maybe even further back for your whānau and et cetera.
Yeah, no problem. The wine side of things started probably late 2002, 2003, or previous to that. I grew up on our family farm with my father and his brother, and I grew up farming potatoes, farming various crops, and my parents and my uncle, they had a French fryer business making potato chips out of the potatoes that we were growing, and that was really cool, and we were also farming dairy at the time, and then I'd left school in 1993, I think it was, and worked for my parents and did all the farming, or did all the farm life that you do as a young kid or a young man, really enjoyed it. And then when we got fully into the dairy side of things, I didn't quite enjoy that side of it. And so in 2000, I left and went to America, and for a bit of a 6-month holiday, I ended up staying 2 years. But while I was there, I was driving trucks. And so I got to see the US from one side to the other, and really enjoyed it. But the phone went one day, and my father was quite keen on me to come back to the family business and sort of get back onto the farm and run the dairy side of things. But I wasn't that keen, and he wasn't keen on planting vineyards. And so we sort of had a bit of a compromise, and I came home in 2000, or end of 2002, early 2003, and planted the first vineyards down on the Lower Wairau, which was always considered not a very desirable area for vineyards. But as it is today, it's become some of the most desirable lands to have in Marlborough for vineyards. So,
So what sort of sparked that interest or that idea of planting wine? Was that while you're in the US?
I left, Marlborough was fast changing at that time into vineyards, and friends from school and guys I played rugby with, they were all on, from their family farms, and they were all changing into vineyards. And it looked like a very good industry to be involved in from the outside, but we weren't a part of it. And so after some discussions with some of those people, I was quite keen to explore that. And so my father wasn't at the time, but, as I said, we come to an arrangement. And so I came home and planted 100 acres the first year I got back.
Right, so you were obviously able to convince him that it was worth it was worth the go, and you were worth the go. And so that was in the Wairau, you said?
Yeah, that was down the Waito Bar. That's where family farm is.
Yep.
And so, planted 100 acres in 03, and then it went along pretty good. So we planted another 100 acres the following year in 04, and then another 100 acres the following year after that.
And so you were saying there wasn't a lot going on in that area?
Not down where we were. We were the first in that area to put them in, down the Wairau Bar. The water that's under us, and it's all artesian, it's very clean, it's pretty much frost free, and the soils are so good. We've planted a lot of vegetable crops over the years, and there was, we had all the ingredients to run a successful vineyard because we had really good land. So it was hard because we didn't know anything about vineyards, but it was quite easy at the same time because, you know, a grapevine, it's pretty much like a weed. You put it anywhere and it'll grow. Just give it a bit of love and away it goes.
And was that Sauvignon, your first plant?
Yeah, it was all Sauvignon. It wasn't really worth growing any other varieties at that stage. Everything was about Sauvignon. There was a demand for Sauvignon. So we planted all those hectares up, and at that stage we were growing for probably about six different wineries we were supplying our fruit to. And that was good. It was, you know, it was a nice industry. It was a real change from coming from, I guess, a traditional farming background where knowledge really wasn't shared amongst farmers. You know, if you had something good, you sort of kept it to yourself. And I guess what surprised me was coming into this game is that everyone was really friendly. Everyone was, you know, couldn't wait to share what they were doing and, you know, where they made some mistakes and where they did things better. And that was just freely flowing information to everyone. So that was a bit of an eye opener.
Yeah, very, very collegial, isn't it? And has that continued on?
Yeah, it is. It is, I think. It's you know, everyone likes to share ideas and what they're doing and what, you know, what works and what doesn't work. And one thing doesn't work for everyone, you know, different areas of Marlborough have different challenges. And so, you know, it's good that we share knowledge. So, look, we've made a lot of mistakes in the early days of growing grapes. And really what it boiled down to was we had people come in and advise us on certain things, but what it really boiled down to was we went back to some of our traditional farming practices on how we used to run our potato crops and other crops, and you know, we just went back and did the basics, and you know, now we still run those basics in the vineyards now. Everything's about timing, being proactive, not reactive, and so we run those through to today, and so we're very, I guess, how would you be? We're quite forward in our approach on what we're doing on a weekly basis.
You planted the Sauvignon, and that obviously went pretty well because you then kept planting in the subsequent years. And that was that all in that same area initially?
It was. I mean, I had a love of machinery as well. And so at the same time we were planting vineyards in the early days, I started buying grape harvesters and I started to become a contractor as well. So I bought one harvester and, you know, thought I was going to conquer the province with it, and ended up with one customer the first year. And then the following year I landed a contract with one of the big wineries, and so I bought another harvester. And before you knew it, I was buying one or two every year until I got to 12.
Wow.
And so with 12 grape harvesters, not only doing my own, but I was running around all over Marlborough with 12 harvesters, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week through the season. So it was really busy and chaotic.
Well, would it be with your own?
The love of machinery.
Yeah, nice. And managing your own
and still doing our own, yeah. So not only were we doing harvesting, I was got into the building of vineyards as well. We had all the equipment, and so we were going around while we're building people's vineyards alongside doing our own. So, but as we sort of grew, I sort of found that I was always away, you know, looking after other people's vineyards and at the detriment of our own. So in the latter years, we started to wind down the contracting side of things to the point where I don't do any now. Gave that all away because we got too busy. But 2008 came along, obviously the global financial crisis, and while it was really nice growing for many wine companies, all of a sudden Marlborough Sauvignon or New Zealand wine, there was an oversupply. And along with the GFC, you know, the industry took a big whack. And so wineries didn't want the fruit, and if they took it, they were paying, you know, less than half of what we were usually getting. And so that made it really tough to run a business. you know, your costs were higher than what you were getting in. And so that was a bit of a reset for us. We had all these vineyards. We had contracts in place. And lucky enough for us, you know, those wineries still wanted their contracts and took their fruit all bar at a much lower price. So that really sparked the next process, I guess, or the next stage in our lives and in this industry is where the following year I had a block that wasn't on contract. And then so through a mutual friend and a local business here that I was doing a lot of work with who had a winery, we sent some fruit into them. And the guy that I knew was a winemaker at the time made some wine for me, and I had this wine sitting in tank. I wasn't going to let it sit on the vine. And so what I found out was that I could actually sell that wine back to some of the local wineries because, you know, the industry was starting to change again for the better. And there was a bit more margin to be made by doing that process. And so I did that for 2009, 2010. And, you know, it was a way of taking control, I guess, not just being a farm, taking farm gate prices. So I did that for those 2 years. But then I sort of thought, well, I don't know how sustainable that will be going forward, and had a bit of a desire to, come up with a brand that I thought, well, hell, I might as well go the full hog and come up with a brand that would, one, suit us as a family, and two, suit us as an area. And so we came up with the name Te Pa. The area that we're from has always been known as the Pa. Well, you know, if my cousins talk about the area, they'll go, oh, what's happening down in the Pa, you know? And so, the Te Pa was born, named after where we're from. So 2011, we launched Te Pa. Again, you know, I thought, oh, we'll throw this wine in a bottle and I'll go and conquer the world, and found out that, you know, making bulk wine and then growing a brand was two different beasts to handle. So, again, learned a lot from, you know, friends and that were in the industry, and then learned a lot by making mistakes.
Yeah, yeah. Had you expanded your vineyards then by that stage as well, or...?
We had done a few more plantings,
yep.
You know, the years prior,
mm-hmm.
But not to the point where we were, where we were going any further since 2007, really. Because,
mm-hmm.
You know, once the GFC sort of hit, that slowed everything down for a number of years. And so we didn't plant any more.
Yeah.
Since then, my father and I, we acquired another block of land in 2012, I think it was, in the Owltree Valley. That was just under 300 hectare block and had 100 hectares of vineyards in it that we bought. And that was sort of on the back of, you know, there was a lot of hurt in the industry. It was an opportunity. But it was also an opportunity to have a flavour profile from a different valley, and that's when we got into different varietals. So this vineyard had a Pinot Gris, Gewurz, Chenin Blanc, and so that was the starting of us of having, you know, to be able to offer different wines in our portfolio going forward. And so we've since added a few more vineyards since then.
And how was that getting into sort of different varietals in different locations? Was there sort of more to learn then as well about those?
Yes. You know, some of the varietals are more challenging to grow than Sauvignon. Sauvignon's actually very easy to grow. You know, it grows straight, it grows well. It's quite easy to manage as opposed to Pinot Noir, Pinot Gris, Chardonnay. They're all a challenge in themselves, or all manageable, but, you know, they just throw up a different set of challenges. But, you know, you learn to adapt, and it's just farming at the end of the day. Just, again, do the basics, do them well, and, you know, everything, all bar the weather, you should be fine. So the varietals, yeah, I mean, we couldn't be a one-trick pony as a brand. You know, it would have been nice just to produce Sauvignon, but what I found once launching Te Pa was that, one, we needed to offer other varietals to go along with Sauvignon Blanc. And then it got to the point to where I wasn't prepared to let Tapar go into big box retail at that stage. You know, really, it's a premium brand. And so we launched two more brands since 2011, which has been really good. So it sort of completes our pyramid from premium to, you know, middle of the road, and then our everyday wine brand, Par Road, that ticks all the boxes and goes into big retail stores and supermarkets. So we sort of learnt and grew as we went along to today. So, but yeah, the early part of the brand side of things, it was a challenge.
Yeah,
and it was a challenge for at least 3 years. I was traveling the world, trying to, you know, drum up support to take Tapar on, and you know, some of it, there was a bit of success there, but it was really hard, and you know, it was a lot of investment, and at times you thought, geez, you know, have I done the right thing here? We're not sort of getting rid of much, but then what I actually found was there was without realizing that you were actually being watched by buyers from around the world, and they'd see you at shows, and you know, you come year one, you may not meet them. You come year two, they've actually watched you come back, and then by year three, I found that they sort of took you more serious, and they had a degree of comfort. Okay, well, these people are in it for the long haul, and so it was sort of year three and four was when we really started to get going, and I think it was because of just being persistent and still traveling every year, both, you know, in New Zealand and abroad, that you know, we've seen some success for our business to keep growing. So yeah, it's been a hell of a ride.
It was the Awatere when you bought into that in 2012. Was there quite a bit already established there?
Yeah, there was. There was a, you know, quite a few of the larger players were starting to, they had already had vineyards out there. And you had, what's his name, Petey Ellens, you know, he was flat out buying a lot of old farmland out there and converting it. And then you had, you know, a lot of the local sheep and beef farmers out there that were either selling up or and taking the money, or they were converting themselves. And, you know, it's, as you probably know, sheep and wool, and it's a hard industry to be in. And for some of these farmers, the vineyards were a bit of a lifeline for them and for us to, you know, get a better return from the land. So,
yeah. And when did Pinot Noir start for you? Where was that?
Well, it actually started in 2011. I bought a little bit of Pinot Noir to complement our Sauvignon at then. And then probably around 2012, 2013, we contracted a bit of Pinot Noir to fill the brand. We had some Pinot Gris. And then we sort of stuck with the three. And then probably a year or two later, we made a rosé out of Pinot Noir because there was a bit of a surplus of Pinot Noir going around. And so we managed to get on the rosé bandwagon. Rosé was taking off. And so we got into that. And then I think it was about 2015, we got into Chardonnay. And yeah, we have all those varieties going quite well in their own right, but Sauvignon is still, you know, our biggest skew.
You mentioned when you did the purchase back in 2012, you also had a bit of Gewurz, was it, in Chenin Blanc? Did that continue on for you, or?
Yeah, well, my staff know that that's a touchy subject for me because I made a bloody big mistake and I've regretted it ever since. I converted the Chenin Blanc. Because at that time I was like, well, who the hell drinks Chenin Blanc? And, you know, I was quite new to wine as myself and knew nothing about Chenin Blanc. And so I top grafted it and put it into spec into Sauvignon. And, you know, it would have been so nice to have that today. I've kicked myself ever since. I love Chenin Blanc. I buy Chenin Blanc, when I'm traveling overseas it is touchy, but it is what it is. One day we'll I'm more in. But the Gewurz, Gewurz is a hard sell.
Yeah.
People love Gewurz at wine shows and at festivals, but you don't see people going in and buying a bottle of Gewurz. Mm. Very, very rare. And so we were using it to blend in with our Pinot Gris. It had a nice aromatic lift. But in the end, I top grafted that vineyard as well and put it into Chardonnay. And so we take Chardonnay off that block now.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And how did the Chardonnay go? Was that sort of went well from the start or a bit too
When we launched our first Chardonnay, you know, we did really well with it. It was highly scored, and I think we made, I don't know, 300 or 400 cases, and it all sold out really fast. And so the following year we made some more, and, you know, we got a really good some scores with the New World Wine Awards, and again, it all sold out. So we've been lifting our Chardonnay program every year, and now can't give you the volumes off the top of my head, but we're making some significant volumes of Chardonnay now. And you know, my team, my winemaking team, along with my viticultural team, you know, everyone's doing a fantastic job in their own part of the growing season or winemaking side of things. And you know, what we're putting out is, well, without being biased, it's pretty good. Really nice. And so, you know, that Chardonnay for us is something that sells out every year. And so I think we're doing something right to have that problem or yeah. Good problem.
Yeah, nice. Nice. Okay. And you're doing a little bit of export too, is that right?
Yeah, look, we're probably 70% export as a business. You know, we've grown our domestic market side of things really nicely here. We've got a very good partner with the Beverage Brothers team run out of Christchurch. Real passionate, you know, bunch of guys who really promote our brands all over New Zealand. And so, you know, we've doing really well at home. You know, export is a big part of our business, obviously 70%. And so, that involves obviously a lot of time overseas with our customers, new customers, and yeah, it's domestic and export are, one, I don't favour one over the other, but both of them are doing very well for us as a business.
Yeah, and obviously good, you know, as a business to have that spread, right, to have different markets that you're across, so that you're not reliant on, you're not susceptible to, you know, anything happening in one particular market.
No, look, given how much, you know, vineyards and that we have, we couldn't sell it all here. Unless, you know, there was a catastrophe with a lot of people and their brands all disappeared. So we, export has to be part of our programs. You know, it's, we just have, yeah, a little bit too much that we can't sell the whole thing here. So.
Yeah.
And I think for any business in this industry, you know, yeah, a combination of both is very, really good. I mean, to do well overseas, you have to do well at home. You know, the world's a small place with, you know, the use of smartphones and internet. Your customers overseas, you know, they want to know that you've got a good presence here at home and that you're doing well. It gives them a degree of confidence that they're making the right choice by taking us on over in their part of the world.
And anything you've been particularly enjoying of late? Is there anything that you've sort of been producing that you've or you've changed maybe the way you've done something or something new sort of evolved for you and what you're producing that you've been enjoying of late?
Yeah, there is actually. And this year's a real testament of the hard work that's gone in. So about 5 years ago, I was getting frustrated with, you know, how I guess they call it the monoculture of Marlborough. The vineyards were looking. You know, you fly into Marlborough and they're beautifully manicured vineyards and they look really lovely. But what I didn't like was what was underneath in the soil, and it was, I wasn't happy with soil health and health, how plant health was going. And so I sort of thought about what we used to do when we were back in potato growing, and you know, my father and his brother, they would never plant the same crop twice in the same paddock, but they would always rotate, and you know, 1 minute we'd have, you know, potatoes in one field, and then next year we'd have oats in it, and next year we'd go back to potatoes, and following year we'd do something else. And so I thought about that, and then I had a hateful Roundup glyphosate, and so I didn't like using it. And so what I did is I got rid of all the grass in the vineyards, and we started to do some inter-row cultivating, so deep ripping and to sort of break a few of the vineyard roots. And then we planted probably up to 13 different species down the middle of every row, peas, beans, oats, and clovers, and all sorts of things. And what we found is that, one, it helped loosen the soil up and let it breathe from years of compaction. It allowed the plants to grab some of those trace elements that were hard for them to grab because it was so compacted. So we noticed changes in the wines. But the big thing was that the vineyards changed and they got healthier. And the soil came alive, and all of a sudden we were noticing all this the worms were back, the insects are back, and so the soil was moving, and you know, that was quite pleasing. And so we were basically making natural nitrogen and that was going back into the soil, and so we saw all these benefits. And so now we're one of the few vineyards that are, you know, doing every single row, every second row, every year. We don't use grass. We let it grow up, we crimp roll it down, and then when it stands up again, then we side mulch it. And all the mulching sit under vine and rot down like compost. And so, which has a dual benefit while we're doing that, that's smothering any weeds that are coming through. So we don't really have to control the weeds as much. But the vineyards don't look as nice, but the fruit, the health of the canopy and the soil is way better. And so what we've found in the latter years is that, we've had a drought this year. Our vineyards went through the drought really well compared to others around us that were really struggling, because they didn't have any moisture withholding, and any rain that did come would run straight off, as where ours would soak it up. At flowering with our inter-row work, we found that, you know, we had better heat in the vineyard, so our flowering was much better than others. And you know, while the industry might be 20, 30% down this year, that's not happened for us. And so we're pretty happy with, you know, what we've done and how we're doing it. So, as I said, vineyards don't look as nice as some of the others, but health-wise, they're better.
Wow, that's fantastic, isn't it? That's really, really interesting, and it must be really rewarding too if you've condensed it into, you know, a few minutes, but I'm sure there's a lot of work and trial and error and testing things out and not knowing when you're first heading out how what the results might be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm always open to take a punt on something different along with my team. Everyone in my team's pretty passionate about it, and they like to try and do something different than what's happening over the fence. So it is, you're right, it's a lot of work, it's a lot of risk, and you know, will it pay off? But you know, I think we're reaping the benefits on a year like this year. It's really paying off, and you know, we've just gone through a bit of a blending round with my winemaking team, and you know, I mean, everyone's going to have good wines this year, but we just haven't got one that we would consider a wine that we wouldn't like. You know, we're having to downgrade wine that we wouldn't downgrade, but we have to do it because it all can't go into premium. So
right.
we're in a really good position in that respect. So
yeah, nice.
Yeah, I think it's testament to the team, you know, testament to my vineyard team, you know, at times work through the nights to make sure that we end up with a really good product at the end of the year when the harvest time comes, and same with my winemaking team. And it's, you know, everyone puts the extra effort in, and it's really cool.
Yeah, no, well done. Well, because it is off the argument that doing sort of more of that natural and sustainable practices won't sort of get the output or the outcome, but obviously over the last few years, you've proven that it can.
We know it can because we're doing it, but I think more and more will start to go that way. While we do the bowling type, well, I call them the bowling green vineyards, while they look good, I don't believe they are good. So, and more and more people are starting to look at alternative ways of growing fruit. And, you know, that will always be the case in any farming, practices. You're always looking for the next best thing. And for now, I think we've found it. But then, you know, probably 10 years from now, we'll be talking about something different that we've discovered that's even better.
That's right. And as you say, it's just about being open, isn't it, to what might be put in front of you and trying things out.
Well, you've got to give back. You can't just keep taking from the vineyards every year. You have to return something to them, whether it be compost, mulch, natural fertilizers, whatever. It's got to go back, and you get it back tenfold from them. If you're taking, as some do, they never put anything in.
Mm.
At some stage, you know, it'll go bang and it'll just turn to crap.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. Anything on the horizon for you that's you're looking at doing under your brands, or have you seen anything else that someone else is doing, you've come across, you've particularly liked or been interested in, or maybe even a wine you've had recently that you might have just come across that you hadn't sort of experienced before?
As far as wines, I'm always in a fortunate position of, you know, with a lot of travel comes a lot of tasting of a lot of different wines all over the globe. So do I have a favourite? No. I guess the favourite's the next one to try.
Nothing you're particularly enjoying at the moment or enjoyed over summer?
Oh, look, a go-to wine for me, I really enjoy Napa Cabernet. Those big reds, this time of year is certainly nice, but I've actually ran out. I had my last one a few weeks ago.
Right.
Got nothing left. And so my next trip to the States will be to load up on some more and bring some home. So, I really like that. But, you know, there's not a wine I don't like, to be fair.
There's a lot to try, right? There's, you know, certainly once you start looking offshore, you know, in Italy.
Now and then my winemaking team will run some wine options on a Friday afternoon, and, you know, someone will bring along something a little bit quirky, and we'll, you know, do what a lot do, guess it, what year it is, where's it from, and what varietal. And so those ones are really good to challenge yourselves
and hone in
your palate. But, I don't really have a favourite, to be fair. You know, no. As I said, I like Cabernet, but, you know, I love CF too.
Yeah.
And Chardonnay and Pinot Gris. So, yeah.
It's all good. We finish on the question. If you could have any glass of wine with anyone at any time or anywhere, who and where and what and when would that be for you? And as we sort of talked before we kicked off the podcast, you know, it's probably not a one option answer. It's there's probably lots of, certainly for me, I know it, I'd find it hard to answer the question with just a single one. What would one of those people and wines be, do you think?
I think, as I said there before we started, that's a difficult question. Because there's a lot who you would, but I think there's probably two that stick out for me. Both have passed on, not here anymore, but one would be my grandfather, who, how would I put it? He was instrumental in our family in driving success. And he was a tough dude. He worked hard. He had 21 kids. And he lived and worked our family farm for a very long time. With his wife dying at a very young age, having lots of children. So I think it would be him. And his name is Manny. And I think the reason for that is, I mean, I was alive and probably, he died when I was 3 years old, and I remember getting his walking stick around my backside once or twice. Playing up, but he was old school. But I think he would, given some of the land that we've converted, I think he would really look at that and go, wow. And he'd look at it and go, well, I never thought you could do that on that land. And and I'm talking about a piece of land that's probably not, that we've got, that's probably not good for a lot. And so seeing a successful vineyard on it, I think would blow him away. So yeah, it'd be cool to have one with him. And I guess the other one would be, my Nana.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. You know, she was a good taskmaster and probably thought a lot of us. So, in the success that we had as kids and growing up, you know, so probably those two.
Yeah, nice. Nice. Yeah. I think that'd be pretty special. And for them just to see what that land is producing now and what you and your family have been able to produce off that land and, the satisfaction and joy that it brings to other people too, and the fact that it's going around the world, that would be pretty amazing for them as well, I think. So,
I think so. I mean, I still get a kick when I walk into a restaurant and a bar or somewhere on the other side of the world and you walk in and see your brand sitting there.
Yeah.
You know, that's a pinch me moment.
I can imagine.
Pretty cool, you know. So, yeah, I think both of them would be quite proud, I think. No doubt I would have worn the old walking stick a few more times if he was around, the old bugger, but look, it is what it is. As I said, that's a tough question because there's plenty more.
Yes, sure.
That you could do that with.
Well, we'll ask it again some other time. Thanks, Hazy. I really appreciate you taking the time and well done on what you've achieved, what your team and your family's achieved. That's fantastic. And we look forward to seeing what else comes out over the next few years.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's, I guess, the challenge for us now and what we need to do, we're at that step now where we need to build our own winery. And so that's the next challenge for us as a business. We've had a really good ride with those that have provided facilities for us to get to this point in time, but there's a need for our own space now and, you know, I've got to go and talk nicely to the bank and hopefully they'll, you know, give us some more money and we'll go and build a nice winery that we can control the whole thing and, you know, hopefully we'll make better wines by doing it when we want to instead of what we're currently doing. So,
Very good. Well, good luck with that conversation.
Yeah. All good. Oh, look, thanks for having me on, Boris. It was... always nice to chat and then, please get in touch down the track and see how we're going.
Yeah, we'll do. It's been a pleasure. Good luck with your upcoming overseas trip as well.
Oh, good. I'm looking forward to it. Sushi in Japan is different than sushi anywhere else.
Yes, exactly. Perfect. All right. Thanks, Hazely.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
We've been speaking with Hazely McDonald from Taipa Wine in Marlborough at the top of the South Island here in New Zealand. If you'd like to find out more, you can go to taiparwines.com. The link will also be in the description to their other brands as well. And be sure to check out some of the other podcasts about topics here in New Zealand on podcast.nz and also have a listen to some of the other New Zealand wine podcasts with other people working here in the wine industry here in New Zealand. We appreciate you listening in. This episode was brought to you by Bizebu.com. Let's get your business started. And we look forward to your company again very shortly. Mā te wā. Bye for now.